KALW.
We are using 5150s more often to just get people off the street and to assess them for their mental health issues.
What kind of care does someone get if they have a mental health emergency?
At the end of the day, people just end up back to where they started, which is the streets.
Today, a look at San Francisco's policies when people are in crisis. Then a Burning Man artist shares his work.
String is a pretty basic material, but you know, never underestimate your materials, I was once told.
And we'll hear about a group trying to make the festival more accessible.
I would not have come as a 63-year-old grandma on crutches without the knowledge that Mobility Camp existed.
A story from our series, The Intersection. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Last year, San Francisco received about 24,000 emergency calls for mental health crises. But what happens after the call goes out to first responders, and what's being done to provide long-term support? KALW News editor Sunni Khalid spoke with San Francisco Public Press reporters Jessica Prado and Madison Alvarado about their investigation examining the city's strained mental health care and detention system.
Let's start. I read the first piece, and it talked about when someone is in mental health distress, and the number 5150 comes up. Madison, could you tell our listeners exactly what 5150 means?
5150 is a term that describes a 72-hour involuntary mental health hold. So basically, when someone is either a danger to themselves, a danger to others, or a category called gravely disabled, which means basically that they're unable to care for themselves, whether that be, you know, getting food, water, obtaining necessary medical care as a result of a mental illness. So if you are a danger to yourself because of a mental illness, you are assessed by either a law enforcement official or someone who is a certified healthcare worker who can do this assessment and basically say, okay, you're a danger to yourself because of a mental illness or a danger to others because of a mental illness. So you can be placed in a hold for up to 72 hours in a designated facility. And the hold can last up to 72 hours. But if you get to a place where you've kind of calmed down and you're no longer a danger to yourself, then you can be released early. And if it continues up to 72 hours, they can assess you again and you may be held for a longer period of time.
Now, both of you started working on this series months ago, and I was trying to figure out how big this problem is. Then I saw the number that jumped out to me when I read the series was 24,000 calls, emergency calls for this. Jessica, when you started working on this piece, when you work with the homeless and you have chronicled your own experience with homelessness, were you surprised at how large the problem is?
I was actually not surprised that there was this many amount of calls, because that's a pattern that I've actually picked up on, is that we are using 5150s more often to just get people off the street and to assess them for their mental health issues. But unfortunately, one thing that we found while doing this research is that people might be able to go through the system, like the criminal justice system or the health system. And at the end of the day, even though they get 5150 so they can be assessed and taken to care, that doesn't really happen. So people just end up back to where they started, which is the streets.
One of the things that I thought was both revelatory but also confusing was you had this graph, this diagram, which is sort of like a Babes in Toyland maze. So let's start. Your first piece was basically what happens when someone, when a 5150 is called, and one of the non-governmental agencies that works on this was Crisis Response Team, went to an address and there wasn't anybody there. So walk me through this. How difficult is it for someone to gain access to this system? And then what happens to them after they access it?
We are trying to understand, like you said, how frequently these calls are happening. And so oftentimes for people experiencing homelessness on the street, they're very visible, right? So when someone is experiencing a crisis in their home, if they're alone, you might not see, but on the street, you're just out there on the street. And so what often happens is someone will call 911, a bystander, and they are going to describe to a dispatcher on the other line sort of the situation as they understand it. But it's difficult because you might not know this person. You don't know their medical history. You don't know how long they've been in crisis, et cetera. You're just describing what you're seeing. And so the dispatcher is going to ask a series of questions to try to understand the situation in a little bit more detail. They are going to ask, is this person carrying a weapon? What kind of weapon are they carrying? Do they seem threatening? Like all of these lists of questions that they're asking to try to ascertain which teams to send. Are they going to send the police? Will they send an alternative to the police, like the street crisis response team? Are they going to send a paramedic? So they're asking all of these questions to try to figure out which team to respond. And then they will send out the call to whatever team they've decided is going to be the best team to respond. And then it becomes, is that team available? And how quickly can they get there? And so that kind of kicks off this whole process. And then once a team is sent out, like you said, that person who was in crisis might not be on that street corner anymore. And so the team might show up and not be able to find who was described on the phone call. And maybe they'll look around and that person doesn't appear to be there anymore. And so, yeah, we found that a lot of times when these emergency response teams show up, they report that they're not actually able to find the person who is in crisis. And so it's a big problem.
Jessica, we talked about the sort of the macro of this problem. What is the micro? The people who are actually in crisis and the people who are treating them, what are they telling you about how difficult it is?
We have spoken with people that have gone through the mental health system. I think one of the biggest issues for them is actually knowing where they can find care. So the obvious choice for them has been to go to the emergency room because that's the only available place where they can go 24/7 to actually attempt to get care. Although sometimes we found that people are just waiting in the hallway at the emergency room because there are no beds. So even though this place exists, it's also like overwhelmed right now with a lot of patients that just keep coming in. So people that are like in mental health holes, they're not getting the treatment that they need. Sometimes they're not even getting a bed. Sometimes they have to wait 24 hours until a bed becomes available so they can stay the remaining time of their hold. And one thing, that biggest issue too that we found is that people are not able to get connected to services after they exit the emergency room. So they might be able to make the stop, but at the end of the day, they were only able to get care for one day. You know, they got the medication for this day, made them feel better for the next 24 hours. But then once the hold is over, they get discharged and they're back on the street without their medicine, without knowing where they can go to a health clinic to continue their care. So yeah, one of the biggest issues is just knowing how to navigate the system.
Are there enough people? Are there enough resources? Is there enough urgency to this problem?
Something that a lot of folks talked with us about is kind of the focus in our mental health system on responding to a crisis and de-escalating a crisis, but the fact that there isn't really as much time and attention focused on preventative care. And so we wait until people escalate and get into a situation where you are sending in all these different teams, but like Jesse said, there's not that same follow-up. And so I think some of the people we talked to would argue that it's also about the allocation of resources. And if you can catch someone earlier in the process and make sure they're getting case management and support and helping someone, you know, go to their appointments on time and access resources along the way, then you don't have to then dedicate so much time to de-escalating when someone has really gotten to a really bad place. And so prevention is a really important step, but it's often overlooked. And so our resources are put towards de-escalating these crises that didn't have to get to that point. If we had intervened earlier, maybe this person wouldn't be needing to go to the emergency room because they wouldn't be in such a dire situation.
That was Jessica Prado and Madison Alvarado speaking with KALW News editor Sunni Khalid. We'll have a link to their investigative stories at kalw.org/crosscurrents. We'll be right back. a regular listener, you might know that KLW's been broadcasting in the Bay Area for more than 80 years. But it wasn't until last year that we got a new space that's allowed us to expand our programming into free live events that you can attend. And if you come to visit us, you can see our rotating art gallery. On display right now is art from the Burning Man community. And this week, we'll be bringing you conversations with those artists. Today, we'll hear from Jesse Pemberton. He's most known for abstract metal compositions and sculptural wall mounts. KLW executive producer Ben Trefney talked to Jesse. He begins by asking him about his inspiration for his art.
I had been working with kind of the idea of the azimuth. And for those of you not familiar with what that is or that word, the azimuth is an angle that's used to sort of locate a celestial body down to the horizon. So it's sort of like using a compass, but vertically. And I just think it's such a wonderful relationship between what we see on the ground, particularly out like at Burning Man on the Playa, when you have this vast space and you're constantly looking up and out. And it's a way of kind of relating, you know, an object that's in the sky to a position. And so I also kind of like that as a metaphor. So this kind of the analogy here is sort of observing my key moments throughout, you know, the journey of my life and memories and references that I base my perspective on. And that helped me create some context. So I've done some sculptures and sketches with that. And this painting in the middle, which is titled 270 West, that was the first piece I did for this show. And then I followed that with the sculpture on the left, which is untitled. And then mirror reflected that essentially on the right, with using a string wrapped around stainless nails. So I kind of like this idea of this sort of these fragmented shapes that kind of project outward and kind of create these sort of pointing features. And, you know, and they're also kind of a bit figurative as well, not necessarily intentionally, but, you know, the end result is what it is.
Thank you. So Jesse, you said that this draws upon memories and scenes of your life. Can you tell us some of the inspirations that are in this piece that we're looking at?
Yeah. My family, when, you know, going back to like my grandparents, everybody kind of migrated west. One grandfather from Canada and others from across the U.S. And I was born in California, and I sort of made my way to the ocean essentially and lived along the coast. So that was really kind of a starting point. That was like at the basis of it. And I wanted to reference a philosopher, a poet, and a physicist, because I think they all kind of related to various aspects of this. So I chose Maya Angelou, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Alan Watts to sort of help, you know, kind of highlight and give a little tone to some of this stuff.
Yeah, and on the write-ups that we have on the wall next to that work, you have some of those quotes. Can you read? Do you have those handy?
Sure. Yeah, if we're starting on the left hand there on the wall, the untitled in steel. And this is associated with a quote from Maya Angelou. And she says, "You are the sum of everything you've ever seen, heard, eaten, smelled, been told, forgot. It's all there. Everything influences each of us. And because of that, I try to make sure that my experiences are positive." And I was really inspired by what Maya was saying in her quote. So I wanted to kind of formalize that aspect of, you know, viewing into and through all the parts of the whole and kind of see how they're coming together. And I really like the idea of the shadows and the outlines kind of referencing some of those, you know, those fragments. You want me to go into the middle?
Yeah. So you said that there was a poet, right? So is that Maya?
That'd be Maya.
Okay. How about the physicist?
All right. So we'll move on. That'll be Neil deGrasse Tyson, and that's the piece there in string on the right, which is titled Intertwined. And so Neil deGrasse says, very simply, "The universe is under no obligation to make sense to you." And I always thought that was kind of a very succinct way of putting it. And it kind of reminds myself that, you know, the world is a mystery, and I'm not under no obligation to understand it, yet I try, but it's a very big place. And I think that goes internally as much as it does externally. So, you know, I kind of sort of wanted to kind of go down that path in terms of making a piece of work that would be maybe not completely understandable right away, but that there would be something that was familiar. I mean, string is a pretty pretty basic material, but, you know, never underestimate your materials, I was once told. And one of my intentions was to mount the spool of string so people could kind of keep, you know, wrapping and adding to it, which you're still free to do. It's kind of up there on the shelf, but
I was wondering because you can see the little spool that's like kind of up on the shelf to the right of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I might take you up on that.
All right.
And then who is the third?
All right. And the third is Alan Watts, and he's a philosopher, and he says, things are as they are. Looking out into the universe at night, we make no comparisons between right and wrong stars, nor between well and badly arranged constellations. And I kind of looked at that as, this is sort of another point of kind of relief, right? Especially when you have, you know, self-doubt, or, you know, like artists, we're often being pretty critical on the inside of, you know, what it is we're trying to do. And, you know, it's not always a successful venture. But so I started thinking about, you know, how, like, for me, sketching helps to kind of unconsciously connect those dots, and it lets my hand kind of wander. So I can just have this sort of automatic movement, and sort of how people would trace their eyes, you know, around the stars, looking for a constellation or a pattern. And there's a bit of a relief to that. There's a much greater world out there that, you know, it doesn't really care about good or bad. And it doesn't really have that judgmental or that aesthetic sort of, you know, criticism that sometimes we embody as artists. So yeah, just try to let these things kind of happen without too much judgment, and, you know, let the work develop over time and try to keep it honest.
That was Jesse Pemberton speaking with KLW executive producer Ben Trefney. You can come visit us and check out Jesse's art at our downtown San Francisco studio. That's at 220 Montgomery. Our Burning Man gallery will be up for the rest of this month. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now we're taking you from our Burning Man art gallery to the event itself. Burning Man started on San Francisco's Baker Beach and now has over 70,000 attendees in Nevada's Black Rock Desert. The burner community is guided by what they call the 10 principles. One of those is radical inclusion. But what does that mean for people with disabilities? Today, for Disability Pride Month, we're revisiting a story from an episode of the podcast The Intersection that explores what disability advocacy looks like in the desert. Host of The Intersection and KLW Director of Programming David Boyer explores what disability advocacy looks like in the desert.
What do you mean a blind person is going to Burning Man? What are you doing here? Why? How can you understand this? Maybe that's part of the entertainment of why I enjoy going, because it confuses everybody else.
Marcy has retinitis pigmentosa, which has led to the development of cataracts in both eyes and severely limits her vision. She's been coming to Burning Man since 2004, so she's familiar with the layout of the city. Still,
I don't always have a perfect concept of knowing where I am, because mentally understanding the layout isn't the same thing as physically being able to follow the layout. We live in an imaginary city. It's like the sides of the road are imaginary. They're made up by the layout of someone's tents and the layout of someone's cars and the layout of someone's shade structures. So there's like physically no object that you could shoreline.
That's when a person uses the end of a cane to follow a curb or the side of a building or a sidewalk's edge. It's a way people with visual impairments navigate unfamiliar spaces.
But there's nothing at Burning Man that you can shoreline because it's all flat.
In the 15 years since she started coming, Marcy has learned how to be self-reliant at Burning Man.
You have water, a warm fuzzy hat, and a pair of leg warmers, a headlamp. I have a little tiny snack on me. So if you ended up spending the night on the wrong side of the city, it's somebody else's couch and the sun went down, like, well, who gives a shit? One of the lessons I learned about Burning Man that I think applies to everybody out there. Imagine that you are where you are supposed to be, and therefore it's impossible to be lost.
The Burning Man community is guided by the 10 principles, one of which is radical inclusion. But what does that mean for people like Marcy? And what about folks with other physical impediments? How do they get around? Because in addition to the navigational challenges, Black Rock City is massive. It's 5 miles wide, and much of the big art is placed several miles from where people camp. It can be exhausting in the best of circumstances. Now, imagine you're in a wheelchair or on crutches or just can't walk very far. Enter this woman, sitting cross-legged on a big green turtle with googly eyes. That's her wheelchair.
So can you introduce yourself?
I'm Rat Lady. I'm 64. I will be a great grandmother next month. this is what I do.
What she does is run mobility camp.
We're probably about 80% mobility impaired for one reason or another, and 20% or less able-bodied.
Their motto is radical inclusion by radical accessibility. And that's why they're centrally located in the heart of Center Camp.
This cuts down the distances we have to travel. And that makes a big difference.
And now the name Rat Lady.
I had service rats for 12 years. They would alert me to spasms in my neck and shoulders. Since I don't have normal sensation by the time I would feel them, it was past the point of being able to do much. They would feel those muscles starting to spasm just very minutely, and they don't like the way it feels. So they learn very quickly, if I tell her, she'll make it stop. So it's a win-win for both of us.
Wow.
This is her 9th year here.
And my 7th year, at least partially, leading the camp.
So tell me your Burning Man, like how you ended up at Burning Man.
So I have friends who've been coming for 20 years, and every year they would come home with pictures and stories, and it would always end with, oh, but you could never do Burning Man in a wheelchair. And I was dumb, and I listened to them. And then in 2010, one of them did something stupid and lost their driver's license for a year and said, do you think there's any way you could figure out how to make this work? Because if you'll drive my van, I'll buy your ticket. So then I really seriously started looking to see if it was possible. And I found what at that time was the Department of Mobility, which was the previous version of our camp. So we signed up and we came, and my first year on Playa, I volunteered 110 hours and I've been doing it ever since.
And what did you find when you got here the first time?
Oh, I knew immediately this was home.
Why?
My generation, we set out to change the world, and we did. But at some point, it took a sharp right turn and went off in a completely different direction. And Black Rock City is where we kind of hoped the world would be by now. And so, yeah, it was absolutely home, and that was immediate, and there was no question. And so my passion is that nobody else wastes 15 years listening to people who don't know better. So we make sure that, you know, mobility camp is out there when people are looking.
That's how a guy who goes by Action Wheels ended up here.
So I've been wanting to go to Burning Man for 10 years, and so I've emailed Rat Lady probably 10 times, maybe more. And they have a website that tells you, like, all the checklist for your wheelchair, what not to bring, what to bring. Like, everything that you need to go to Burning Man in a chair.
And how is your chair holding up out here?
My manual chair is doing great. I'm not used to using a power chair, so I have charging issues all the time. But my biggest struggle is drinking enough water.
So this is your first time, and what do you think?
It's amazing. It's really hard to express the amount of kindness and love that everybody has for everybody.
That was an excerpt from an episode that first aired in 2020, produced by KLW's Director of Programming, David Boyer. You can find the whole story and the rest of that intersection season at klw.org/crosscurrents. And if you've been thinking about going to Burning Man and haven't been sure how to do it, check out Mobility Camp's website at mobilitycamp.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Michaela Sia, Christopher Alam, Hussein Khan, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shireen Adil, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.